Hi, Alan.
Hi, Jane.
Good morning.
Anchor this sucker. Very good.
God.
Is that necessary?
There we go.
What is the smoke that's coming up?
Can I start?
Sure.
What do you see the significance of your being an ex-movie star in a film is? Were you conscious when you were playing the part the whole time that you were playing an ex-movie star?
Yeah. We wanted her to inherit the chairmanship of the board from her husband. There's a good deal of dramatic license there, because while it might happen in our lifetime, it has not happened yet, that a woman has assumed that mantle in something that is as central to the American economy as the petrochemical industry. Pepsi-Cola, yes. Max Factor, yes. Advertising agencies, yes. Steel, rubber, petrochemicals, etc., no. Now, how do you justify it? How do you create a character? Now, you could have a woman who came up through the ranks, who was a businesswoman, or you take a woman who is very comfortable with power, and besides a woman who is an experienced businesswoman, women who are used to power are movie stars. Someone who, and there, you know, Joan Crawford, Doris Day, there have been some, Barbara Streisand, not me, who, Hepburn to some extent, who really have their own companies that they run. They negotiate their own deals. They learn about power. It is true, like I'm thinking of Gulf and Western taking over Paramount. That happened at a time when I was making a movie at Paramount, Barefoot in the Park. I met Charles Bluedorn. Had I been older, and had I been a different sort of person, and had I had my own company, and had my company been producing for Paramount, I would have developed a relationship with Charles Bluedorn. I would have, out of necessity, had to learn where the power buttons are in that structure. A movie studio gets bought by a multinational corporation, a petrochemical company, that's headed by a man who is fascinated by movies, who, that's part of the pleasure part of his empire. He likes to rub shoulders with movie stars, is fascinated by movies, but he really runs an entire empire. As a movie star who was, say, under contract to the studio that he bought and who had to do business with him, we could have become friends. We could have become lovers. Poor Charles Bluedorn would die. Let's take his name out of it.
He is going to find out.
But in my head, that was an example of how it could have happened. This was a woman who could, you know, because of being a movie star, was used to fame, was used to fortune, had amassed a tremendous amount of money, has an intuitive instinct for business, marries a man who can teach her a lot more, who runs a huge empire. She finds that movies and acting are less stimulating to her, less challenging to her at a certain point in her life than business, which she finds quite creative. Although a lot of the other people in the business don't know it, she is actually becoming an alter ego to her husband, who's learning to trust her instincts, who is calling upon her when he has to make a lot of decisions. This is how I, in the subtext of the part, saw the development of the woman to a point where she could actually take over the business, even though none of the other men involved knew to what extent she understood how the business was run. She, on the other hand, didn't understand to the extent to which she is simply a pawn, simply a figurehead, because there are chairmen of the board who are real power figures, and there are those who are simply figureheads, and she was the latter, without even knowing to what extent.
But wouldn't she have known that from her experiences in movies?
perhaps, to some extent, but not totally, I don't think.
Did you understand all the financial machinations of this plot?
Not in all the details, no. Just the general overview.
Mm-hmm. Was there some reason why nothing was really shown of your relationship with your husband? I mean, he was killed. You never see, you know, together or what your life was like at all.
Didn't seem all you had to know, really. I mean, we could have done a whole movie just about, you know, about her rise to the place that she was, but we didn't feel that it was germane to the story that we wanted to tell.
I'm watching it, and it reminds me of China Syndrome.
Because both of them are rather pessimistic in their finales, except that, well, they are. Well, I think Syndrome is pessimistic throughout, maybe up at the end. This thing is down. Are you afraid that people are going to identify the Jane Fonda name with the Holocaust movie?
Well, this is the first one, China Syndrome. I don't think that China Syndrome was down. I think that the China Syndrome, in fact, showed at the end that human courage comes to the fore. The guy does tell the truth. He does speak out. He does say the guy was not crazy. He was a hero. It is true that the plant is unsafe. Several different people, including my character, as well as the man inside the plant, as well as the Jack Lemmon character, acted on their conscience. So I think it was a frightening but upbeat movie. This movie is, in fact, I think, a very disturbing movie about what it's saying about the nature of how our economy is run and the degree to which we have become hostage to fanatics.
Not only that, but those forces surrounding us, we don't understand them, basically. It's a question of being held hostage by something almost incomprehensible.
That's
In
right.
Fact, I think even economists rarely would ever agree about what they're doing. There are so many differences of opinion about where the world's economy is going. Even they don't understand the force of money.
When you call the Arabs fanatics, don't you believe that from their point of view we're just as fanatic as they are with our Christian God and so forth?
I think they'd like the flood to reoccur and just wash us heathens off the face of the earth.
That wasn't really my question, though. I mean, from their point of view, aren't we just as fanatic as they seem to us? I mean, don't you feel that
perhaps.
There's a certain amount of logic behind their protecting their capital because of the fact that they have an expendable supply of oil?
Oh, I think so.
Just as we're using their oil and we have an expendable supply of capital?
Oh, I think from their point of view, they have a finite amount of oil, and that's all they've got going for them. The dollar is declining in value, and they are continuing to exchange their finite, precious resource for paper that's losing value. And it's almost to the point where it would benefit them more to leave the oil in the ground. I think that's true. The issue is, how come our national leaders have allowed this country to become a house of cards, to become so vulnerable, to become so dependent on their oil? It's not necessary. We didn't have to be put into that situation. And on top of it, they are highly unstable. I mean, look at Iran. All of the Mideast experts that I've talked to feel that with Saudi Arabia, it's just a matter of time. They're undemocratic. They're tyrants, they're anti-women, they're anti-free press, they're fanatic fundamentalists. And in the hands of these people rests our national security is just insane. And I there's only one solution to it, and that is for us to overcome our addiction to their oil. And fast, if it's not already too late.
Clearly you have serious concerns in this film and the other films that you've made in recent years. Are you satisfied with the mixture of serious comment and entertainment that you've been able to mix in the two pictures? When Alan was here, we were talking about the danger of this picture not being taken seriously enough because it's done in a big theatrical manner in some ways. Are you happy with the blend, or are you worried that it's one side or the other?
This is certainly the most ambitious subject matter we've tried to tackle. It's much more complex than the nuclear issue and the China syndrome, because while one doesn't understand the technical jargon in the China syndrome, everyone knows what's at the core of that plant, and everyone knows what will happen if there's an accident. Very few people understand banking. Very few people understand the ramifications of what happens if it's not rolled over. You know, they don't understand how vulnerable the banks are because of all the petrodollars that they could be withdrawn so quickly. So you're trying to explain a whole lot in a movie, as well as develop a melodrama. Very ambitious. I'm glad we tried it. I mean, I think it's the most important issue of our times. There's nothing as important as this. And, I don't know, got to try to deal with it and address it. And I'm not sure, and won't know till it opens and till we see how the public responds to it, whether or not the combination of the melodrama and the political and economic underpinnings do mesh properly and will be acceptable. I don't know. I like the film. I'm proud of the film. I think it's an intelligent film, and I'm glad that we tried. You know, that we've tried to do this.
What got you on it?
Where did the idea come from?
Where is it? Yeah. Where's it born?
Well, for about 4 years, it's the issue that I and my husband and the organization that we work with and the people that we deal with in California talk about the most, are concerned about the most, try to understand the most. It's one of the reasons that we're so adamant in our pushing alternative energy and conservation, because the oil companies and the utilities can say all they want, it's pie in the sky. That is the savior. Conservation and alternative energy is what will save us from vulnerability to the Arabs. And if we don't have it, it's because of the unholy alliance between the oil company and our government. And I don't mean just the Reagan administration. I mean parties across. It's a bipartisan problem. The problem didn't start with the Republicans.
At the same time, Hume Cronin in the film discusses the fact that money has a force of its own and goes where it will. The best we can do is try and channel it. It's almost as if there's an implication there that the forces may be out of control, that there is no way to ultimately control, just help shade.
Yeah.
Rather a bleak message there.
I'm not going to defend that because I don't understand it. I just sort of thought, well, I wish that wasn't there. But maybe Max Emery would say it. I don't even know what it means, frankly. I don't agree with it. You know, I'm somebody who firmly believes that an activated, alerted citizenry can control the flow of money. It's when we turn it over to the so-called experts and abdicate our responsibility that the problem starts. You know, and I'm not in favor of endless regulations and a lot of government involvement and bureaucracy, but when it comes to something as fundamentally important as our economy and how it's run, we need regulations. You know, it's like a cannonball rolling around the hull of a ship with nobody paying any attention to it. I mean, there's untold billions of dollars of Saudi money in this country, and no one really knows where it is. No one knows the extent to which they own our land.
And it may not even be money in the sense that we think of money. It's numbers on a computer sheet.
Well, controlling shares of stock in our major corporate, in the strategic sectors of our economy. No one really knows the extent to which. Because, you see, they are only forced to disclose if they own over 5% of the stock of any company. How many companies do they have 4.9% of stock? And in how many companies is 4.9% of stock virtually controlling interests? I mean, we don't even know that. And we don't elect or know the faces or names of the American economists and bankers that are helping them do it for a sizable commission. That's the point that I think we're trying to make in this movie. Hey, we better take a very close look at this, because we have no idea what's being done in our names. Not even the president or the Federal Reserve Board knows what's going on. And in a democracy, it should be illegal. And the funny thing is that it's not illegal. When Hume Cronin says, as Max Emery in this movie, "Nothing I've done is illegal," it's true. And that should scare the hell out of us.
And at the same time, personal interests, for example, Lee Witter's interest in saving her company, precipitates the global crisis.
That's right.
And yet she's acting in the interest of her company.
That's right. That's right. I liked playing someone who didn't see the light at the end. I know some people will not like that, but I just thought it was good that at this point that I played somebody who was not on the side of the angels.
Did you like dressing spectacular?
Not in the beginning. I must say the costume fittings were a total trauma for me. I found it extremely difficult. But as I got into it and I got used to wearing the clothes and I got used to the character, I did enjoy it.
Do you like the woman you play? Not as a part, but as a woman.
No. No, I don't. I understand her. I understand her.
Is that the first woman you played you haven't liked?
No, I didn't like the woman that I played in California Suite either.
Why didn't you like her?
The one in California Suite? Oh, because she was... There was a speech where her ex-husband, Alan Alda, described her and her crowd. Poochie pants at a fundraiser for the farm workers on Martha's Vineyard. And it was absolutely true. And I don't like those kind of armchair liberals, and didn't want to be identified with them, and found it extremely difficult to act her. In fact, all through the 2 weeks of rehearsal, I was here walking alongside the character over there, and it didn't work at all. And it wasn't until I kind of found ways to identify with her and like her that I was able to play her. And the same was true with Lee Winters. I thought a lot about my mother, as a matter of fact. My mother was born very poor, married rich, was ambitious, found comfort and identity and status, and was a brilliant businesswoman.
In your research on the role of Lee, what position do women play in the high positions of economy?
None. Unequivocally none at all. It's a male club, white male club.
Could you elaborate a little more on what you didn't like, what you disliked about Lee Winter?
About
Lee Winter, because what you disliked about her, because I think in terms of film, she comes off as a fairly attractive character.
I don't have much particular sympathy, understanding maybe, but not much sympathy in someone who's mainly out for number one, regardless of the cost, who enjoys power plays for their own sake, who, in the words of Henry Kissinger, finds power an aphrodisiac. They both do, both the characters, the man and the woman of Hub Smith and Lee Winters, find power aphrodisiacal?
Yeah.
Aphrodisiacal? I don't even know what the word.
Aren't those exactly the qualities that make men in these positions of control? I mean, if you don't like a woman who has those qualities, why can you complain that women aren't in positions of control in commerce? Don't they have to get involved in power plays and be lookout for number one if they're ever going to compete in the boardrooms?
Well, I don't like the
boardrooms at all.
No. I mean, I don't think that it's necessary to run an economy or a country or a business that way. To some extent, I think the Japanese are showing us that you can run very successful companies. In fact, they run some of their companies more successfully than we do, with different kinds of priorities. Their corporate priorities put worker stability, the environment first, and corporate profits second. Their corporate executives, they're not figureheads, but they don't have the ultimate power to the extent that they do here. I am one of those feminists who feel that if women want to share power, we shouldn't be saying we want to share power as it exists today. We don't want a slice of the pie of the system if the pie is going to remain the way it is, because it's not doing men any good as well as women. It's alienating to men. More and more corporate executives are unhappy, are expressing that unhappiness in many ways, are in fact dropping out in record numbers. I'm reading the Yankelevich book, New Rules. Very, very interesting in terms of how those kind of things are changing. So I think women should be up there, and I think that women being there can, not necessarily will, but could alter the corporate power plays.
And rather than being a cold world, these corporate power plays, I think the film makes it clear that it's one of high emotions. Those people in those rooms in front of those consoles, highly agitated, capable of being triggered by emotions and things. Maybe the wrong kind of input to go into corporate and economic planning. Except what's the alternative, you know?
Democracy.
When things get
economic democracy.
Yeah, when things get that complicated, what kind of changes can be made in your view? Where does one even start?
I think that the corporate decision-making process in banks as well as in big corporations, I don't mean all companies, I mean the corporations that are strategic to our economy and our national interests, have to be democratized. You have to have voting positions and positions of real power and decision-making power, representatives of labor, representatives of environment, representatives of consumers, present when decisions are made, so that you can't have a few individuals, for whatever reasons, subjective, personal interests, or thinking that they're doing the right thing, in sole positions of power.
And our own understanding of those complexities is pretty crucial to that. I mean, that's our responsibility.
Yeah. I mean, very often, I think, you know, I think we all know this, again, the so-called experts mystify things. It's not that these are simple things, but they can be understood. They can be understood. If anything is so complicated that it can't be understood by most people, then there's something fundamentally wrong with it. Basically, one should be able to understand. An average citizen should be able to understand enough to participate.
Do you think part of the problem has been in some of the Harlequin novels and films like The Other Side of Midnight and things like this, where the world of economics is so glamorized, that we then fail to perceive some of the more ominous and dangerous aspects of it? We still see it as a melodrama and not a real problem.
I don't know. The only book like that I've read, I don't read novels too much, but I read, I've read all of Erdman's books. Not a great writer, Erdman, but he knows whereof he speaks. He's been in jail for it. He's a banker. And I thought The Crash of 79, for example, was a very, very good book. Very good book. Melodrama, you know, glamorized and all that, but at the heart of that was, I think, frighteningly truthful. Very important in terms of understanding how the decisions are made and why and what's at stake.
Jane, your career has took rather miraculous turn. I think, correct me if you disagree or disagree with me. Like, you, I think by your own admission, you felt that after Clute, you really couldn't find work. I thought I read somewhere that you said that you had difficulty finding films.
With a little help from my friends.
Well, of course. Then with Julia, I guess that was the first you come back, and now you're stronger in my estimation than you ever were. And do you think this could have happened, say, back in the 30s or 40s or 50s?
In the 30s and 40s, not in the 50s. I would not be here today if this was the 1950s. People who were a lot less outspoken than I were destroyed.
Like Larry Parks.
Parks, Paul Robeson, Helen Gahagan Douglas, and many others. In the hands of HUAC and Richard Nixon. This is not the 70s, much as Nixon tried, was not the 50s. I'm working, he's out of a job. and I personally, frightened as I am of the moral majority and what it represents, I don't think that we will return to the 50s. I think we're too alerted to the problems. No, I don't think so. I don't think so.
You really don't think it's happening? You don't think?
I don't think the moral majority speak for the majority. I don't think they're moral or major.
Maybe
they're rich, hence outspoken and very powerful.
Maybe one small part of that reason is that movies do have relatively more freedom in what they could do.
Yeah.
The stranglehold is not there.
Yeah.
Jane, 9 to 5 is the number one selling cassette in history, where people would take home and play through their video recorders. Why do you think, I mean, that's the real vote when somebody spends $49 for a movie. What the kind of chord did it strike? I mean, it's outselling Gone with the Wind or African Queen or Casablanca or Singing in the Rain or anything else.
I think most people work and most people have at one time or another been subjected to bullying. And the movie spoke to that. They spoke to what it feels like to be bullied, and then to make everything even better, the working people won. They were proven right. They were proven that when they had their way, they could run things better. And in their hearts, I think most people feel that, that if they're given a chance, if the people at the bottom who really understand how businesses run were given a chance, they could solve a lot of the problems. So it was a It was entertaining, but also very identifiable, and it was upbeat. And yesterday was the first day of filming on the TV series of 9 to 5, which is going to be sublime.
Jane, how was Chris Christopherson? How does he rate among your leading men? Did you find him charismatic?
From 1 to 10? I don't know. Chris has been a friend of mine for a long time. I am very proud of Chris in this movie. You got to understand, Chris doesn't have a checkbook. Chris, at least that's what he told me, that he is so ignorant about the whys and wherefores of money, they won't even let him have a checkbook. He is very smart. He understood right at the get-go the nature of gamesmanship. And I like the unexpectedness of his playing this part, and it took a lot of guts. It took a lot of guts for Chris to take this on. And he worked very, very hard, and it was very exciting for Alan and I to watch him, to watch him grow. I mean, he before our eyes, you know, like one of those things that your kids put in water, those rock gardens that you drop in water and they begin to expand. That was like Chris. I mean, he just grew in the part and gained tremendous confidence through mastering this role.
Did you find him attractive or charismatic? As a
God, are you kidding?
No.
You think I'm dumb?
No,
I think he's divinely charismatic.
I wouldn't have recognized him.
Great looking and mainly very funny. I think we laughed a lot. A lot.
What distinguishes most of your films is that your character usually has women friends or male friends. In this film, your character had neither. I suppose that was by intention.
Yeah. I don't think this woman has a woman friend. I don't think she likes women. And her male friends are lovers. I think she has a lot of lovers. We find her at this point, you know, with her husband dying, so you don't explore that part of her life, but I think that's the kind of woman she is. It was very weird, the couple of scenes where I have to walk down these corridors in banks, flanked by desks that were just like the desks in 9 to 5, at which were sitting women just like in 9 to 5, that I was like in my film before this, walking down with my nose in the air, not even looking at them. I mean, she's the kind of woman, they are faceless robots as far as she's concerned.
Did I miss something?
It's weird.
Did I miss something, or is her servant, the person she addresses, never on camera?
She's on camera a few times.
She helps to put on a dress.
I had the impression she was always saying off screen, have the car ready or get the locks changed.
Yeah, I think only once or twice do you ever see her.
Jane, have you read your father's autobiography?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of it?
I wish that I'd read it 20 years ago. I learned a lot, especially reading about his early life, that I found very moving. How hard he had to work to put himself through school, how it helped me understand a lot about why he never wanted Peter and me to grow up spoiled rich kids. He never wanted us to take for granted any of the things that we had. If he would give us a toy and we lost it, that was it. He had to work for everything he had to put himself through school. He literally starved for years in New York. I also never thought of him as somebody, because he's so shy and unaggressive about himself, that the vision of him, he was described in it as the best-known unknown actor, because every day pounding the pavement, going to the offices of the agents that would give him work. I can't imagine him doing that. How he suffered when his first wife left him for another man. I mean, all these kind of things that you never find out about your parents. That's what's so strange about being the child of a famous person, is that you see all these intimate details when their book comes out, if the book is honest, which this one is.
You indicated yesterday in an interview that he seems to be doing pretty well in the hospital. Have you had any more contact with him?
Talked to him last night. I wanted to call him because in the course of... I was moving all over yesterday and running into a lot of critics who had just seen On Golden Pond and who were clearly as deeply moved as I have ever seen critics to be, and expressed themselves to me, and besides that, just everyone asking how he is. I mean, just everybody, drivers and people in the streets and people in the TV stations, and I wanted to convey that to him, so I called him in the hospital and told him, and I could just hear his spirits, you know, that he's very angry. He's angry about being so sick, and I could just feel him lighten up.
Have you read the Playboy interview, by the way?
Yeah. Crotchety old guy,
yeah,
isn't he?
He
comes across pretty crotchety.
Did you talk to him about any of the things he said, which, in that particular article?
No, this is not the time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.